I'm Steve Chaney, the CEO of the American Security Project, and we cover a number of topics here. We were formed in 2004, 2005 by Senators Hart, Kerry, Hagel, and Rudman, names I'm sure you're familiar with, to cover a number of topics, not the least of which were energy security, nuclear security, climate change, terrorism, and asymmetric operations. And we've done a number of events about all those particular topics. But today's is particularly timely, I would suppose, given what's going on in Iraq and the crises and the business, and I presume that's why most of you are here to get the true scoop. And today's take on it is a little different from most. And I'm very pleased to have Dante Disparte and the folks from Clements Worldwide here to talk about risk management in the Iraq crisis, and not just in Iraq, but I think you're going to perhaps go some other places in the world to discuss this, and we have a most distinguished panel. So what I'm going to do is turn it over to Dante to run this show. He'll have each of them speak. Then we'll do a little Q&A afterwards. We'll try to finish by 1:30 and on time. So with that, let me turn it over to Dante.
Thank you. So again, thank you, General Cheney, and the American Security Project for hosting us. I think the fact that we've defied a Wednesday, a summer, and a lunchtime to get this many people in a room on the topic of ISIS in Iraq and what are the implications says a lot. I think it matters to a lot of the people in the room. It matters to American foreign policy. It matters to firms, crisis management firms, and others operating in the region. So I'm very pleased to contribute to this dialogue and try and figure out if we could make some sense in the hour that we have with this great panel of this very fast-moving situation. So what prompted the debate, and just in a second I'll introduce my panelists, what prompted this meeting was effectively watching the headlines, and in the course of a few weeks, a country that we've spent billions of dollars propping up, we've sacrificed lives, we've sacrificed treasure, opportunity costs, there's a whole range of debates that you could put out there. To watch the whole thing unravel the second the United States and the foreign community effectively went for the exit, as quickly as it has unraveled, it begs a lot of questions. And I think some of those questions will come out on the panel. And then at the same time, it had a series of operational implications for our customers. So Clements insures customers in more than 180 countries for everything from political risk and all of the things that can happen in between. And I started asking myself, you know, no matter what the foreign policy implications, and while nations are grappling with a response, firms, companies, and individuals remain exposed. They can't just make their assets magically disappear in Iraq. And so how then can we get some practical tips on how to deal with this? So that was one angle that I think we'll explore this afternoon. Another angle is, while Iraq is grabbing headlines and it's absolutely an attention-grabbing country and the situation is unraveling very quickly, I don't think it's isolated. I think Boko Haram in Nigeria raises a specter that this is the same thing that's happening in Iraq can happen in Africa. The speed with which Mali unraveled during the Tuareg rebellion raises that specter. The airport in Karachi in Pakistan withstood sustained attacks. So again, I don't think it's an isolated event. This was the intent of this afternoon's session. So to my right, we have our first distinguished panelist, Missy Ryan, national security correspondent with Reuters, has lived in Baghdad, lends a lot of legitimacy to this panel. So Missy will open up the conversation this afternoon. Further to the right, we have Major General Bob Scales, former commandant of the U.S. Army War College, and has been stationed in many countries, written extensively about national security. Further down the line, we have Mr. Daniel Wagner. He is a foremost expert on the subject of country risk management, political risk insurance, and what companies and individuals can do before the fact. I think the adage that you cannot worry about risk when the house is on fire is an apt one, and Daniel will share some of his experiences in that front. And then last but not least, my colleague Smita Malik, who is our Assistant Vice President of Special Risks, lots of experience on some of the financial solutions that are available to firms to put a fixed price on uncertainty. So with that, Missy, we'll turn it over to you to open up the debate.
Thanks, Dante. It's a pleasure to be here today. And I'm really looking forward to your questions. I'm going to keep my remarks very short. And I'd just like to give you a brief overview of the military and political situation that we've seen over the last few weeks. I'm sure much of this will be familiar to most of you here in the room. So really, the event that catalyzed the whole conversation here today was the stunning advance of the Islamic State in Iraq and in the Levant, now known as the Islamic State, which swept across much of northern and western Iraq and captured Iraq's second largest city, Mosul, on June 10th. And this event seemed to catch not only the Iraqi government, but the U.S. government off guard. And despite the fact that we spent more than $25 billion, the American government, building up the Iraqi security forces from 2003 to 2011, one of the most dismaying elements of this situation was the fact that much of the Iraqi military abandoned their posts in the face of the ISIS advance. Since then, the Iraqi military has tried to recapture lost ground, has hardened its defenses around Baghdad, but it's really struggling. Just this morning, the Iraqi army was rebuffed in its attempt to recapture the city of Tikrit, which everyone knows is Saddam Hussein's hometown. This was not the first time that the Iraqi military tried to recapture Tikrit, but it was forced to retreat due to ISIL clashes. One thing that I'd like to note is that after ISIL captured Mosul, the sectarian fissures that we all know about in Iraq seem to leap into the foreground again. And one feature of this was the fact that after a ruling from the country's highest Shiite cleric, Ali Sistani, tens of thousands of Iraq Shiite militiamen mobilized to try to fight back ISIL. On a similar development, the Kurds in their semi-autonomous region have really been much more successful than the Iraqi military in keeping ISIL at bay. The Peshmerga forces have been quite effective. They not only defending the northern region of Kurdistan, but also in seizing the city of Kirkuk, which is abandoned by the Iraqi military. And it's important to note, I think, that the insurgency that the Iraqi government is grappling with right now does not just include ISIL. And we think of ISIL, we think of some Iraqi and some foreign jihadi fighters motivated by Islamist ideology. It also comprises Iraqis affiliated with the Ba'ath Party and with the Saddam-era military, some of whom purportedly are under the command of people like Azat al-Dori as part of the Naqshbandi army. On the political front, as we all know, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's State of Law party won a comfortable lead in the April elections. And while Prime Minister Maliki clearly wants a third term, he's facing a lot of criticism that is not new and that has really been a problem since the 2010 elections. Criticism from his Sunni and Kurdish opponents who believe that his sectarian tendencies have really helped push Iraq into this current crisis. They complain that he's marginalized him using the largely Shiite security forces against minority elements in Iraqi society and trying to shut down Kurdish aspirations for greater economic and sort of territorial autonomy. There are a few encouraging signs. Just yesterday, the Sunni parliament elected a new speaker, which is like the first encouraging sign after weeks of deadlock. Salim al-Jabouri is a moderate Sunni. And I think this is a good thing, but it doesn't mean that the political crisis is at all over. Now the government has, I think, a period of 30 days to choose a president who will come from the country's Kurdish community, and then a Shiite prime minister will be selected. And this is really the most difficult question. Maliki shows no signs at all that he is willing to relinquish power, quite to the opposite. He seems to be interpreting even statements from the Sistani camp that suggest that he needs to step down as support for him. Recently, though, we've been told by members of his State of Law party that they're sort of coming to grips with the fact that they might need to find an alternative to Maliki. And the final political point that I'd mention is that the Kurds, meanwhile, seem to be quite emboldened since the government in Baghdad has really been shown to be weak and ineffective in the face of ISIL. President Masoud Barzani of the KRG has announced that they're really considering this referendum, which might put Kurdish independence to a vote. And the big question is, will countries like Turkey and the United States support that quest? And finally, I know that Bob is going to speak about the U.S. response, but that's really a big question in my mind right now, is how direct and assertive a military response the United States will provide in helping Maliki or whoever is the next prime minister try to recapture this land and make sure that Iraq doesn't fracture into these three ISIL, Shiite-controlled, and then Kurdish-controlled components.
My turn. Thank you, Missy. I had a wonderful U.S. Army War College presentation to give to you this afternoon. Each of you would have received 3 credit hours to the War College as you left the room. But over the last 3 days, 3 or 4 days, I've gotten literally ambushed by many of my colleagues who have extensive experience, recent experience in Iraq. And one yesterday in particular, I was ambushed by a group of folks who have just come back from Iraq and were instrumental in either reviewing or writing the interim report that CENTCOM has put together. And without mentioning any names or where I was or any particulars, I'd like to trash my War College speech and tell you what they told me about conditions in Iraq. This may be a little different than what you're reading in the media, but in the next 12 minutes, I'll try to do that. Remember, these are private conversations and they're unfiltered, but I think they're pretty telling. First thing they told me is it's not all bad news. They said, you know, landing at Baghdad International Airport, it's not exactly like, you know, Stalingrad in 1943. You get off the plane, things seem to be perfectly normal. They were surprised at the calm in Baghdad, people going about their business in the usual fashion. There were more checkpoints, of course, a few rallies here and there. But for the most part, they found the country to be, at least the Baghdad part of the country, to be fairly calm. Baghdad seems safe. There's some pressure in the southwest, some pressure in the northwest suburbs of the city, but the Shiite militias seem to be handling that fairly well. And there's no evidence that IS is all that interested in pushing into essentially Shiite territory. So the remnants of the regulars, according to the folks I talked to, are actually pretty good. And have held up well. These are the commandos, these are the special police commandos that we have been training for years, and who are relatively immune from over-control by the politicians. But the elite units are doing well, and many of the attacks that were made into Crete yesterday and the day before were actually conducted by these units rather than the regular army. Kind of tells you a little bit, parenthetically, about how we do advise and assist in the United States, and maybe changing our doctrine, maybe instead of focusing on the masses to focus on elites, but more about that later. Oil flows mostly intact. The Sunnis may have grabbed a lot of Iraq, but they didn't grab a whole lot of oil. And the export for oil right now is actually up. You know, they lost their refinery in, Beji, but that's affecting their mobility, but it's not affecting the export of oil. The war, according to this group, has reached a sort of, to use a military point, culminating point, where you know the offensive can go no further, and the defensive has yet to be able to sort of take over the war and go on the offensive. ISIS seems to be intent on sort of domestic domination within the regions that they've controlled rather than expanding their authority. And they tell me that the Kurds are okay. Peshmerga is intact, 320,000 folks we didn't train, but they seem to be doing fine, and they're holding the line against any attempt by ISIS to infiltrate into the territory. That's the good news. But the general tenor of the folks I talked to was very, very depressing. And it goes like this. There is no hope of the Iraqi government resuming the offensive. Not now, maybe not ever. You've all read in the media about the problems that they have within the Army. Four divisions are virtually gone. First, second, third, fourth divisions are gone. One brigade left, I think, in the second division, but that's it. The centerpiece of the Iraqi Army has simply disappeared. They're out of fuel. Spare parts are in short supply. The soldiers can't even get fed. A lot of the soldiers are being fed actually by charitable groups in Baghdad and elsewhere. The Army's logistics system, whatever it had at the time, has disappeared. The leadership at the brigade level is just terrible. And there doesn't seem, while there's some cosmetic changes of military leadership that Maliki made a few weeks ago, the inherent corruption and political focus of the military leadership, frankly, is left intact. One guy told me, he said, Maliki would rather risk his own destruction than mess with his system of almost mafia-like system of patronage within the Army, and he has refused to replace some of the commanders that were recommended be replaced. And the other thing I found very interesting from this group that I talked to is that there is a strong suspicion that even within some of the regular units and even within some of the elite units, they get the impression that bits and pieces of both Sunni and Shia radicalism are beginning to emerge within these units. Small cells of junior officers kind of reminds you of Egypt in the 1950s that are dissatisfied with both sides, and their common bond is basically to say to hell with the whole bunch and start over again. And that's led to distemper within the units that remained, that remain intact. Military cronyism, they said, is rife, and there doesn't appear to be any desire to get rid of it. Cutting-edge weapons are gone. All their Hellfires are shot. Their major equipment, the expensive equipment that we gave them, is either in the hands of ISIL or awaiting parts. And the Iraqis can't fix them. They talk about ISR's Intelligence Surveillance Reconnaissance black hole. That's one thing they really emphasized to me, that all of this HUMINT, COMINT, SIGINT infrastructure that they spent nearly a decade building into Iraq is gone. I didn't know this, but ISIL got a hold of most of the personal data that Dave Petraeus gave to them that had the Sons of Iraq and all of their data listed on it, and they used that systematically to either execute or imprison those who were our friends back in 2007 and 2008. So a lot of the eyes on, a lot of the boots on the ground, a lot of the human intelligence is gone. Our ability to establish SIGINT is bad. The only thing we have is some overhead, which is sketchy at best, particularly since ISIL has imploded into the cities and really because they're so molecular in these cities, it makes the traditional means of intelligence gathering extremely difficult. So there's two bad choices here, I guess. We have a military that has Shiite militia, but no skill, who are willing to fight and die, but have no military skill. And we have regulars with some skill, but no will to fight. So it's the situation, as I said, is in stasis. And whichever way the American advisory effort decides to go in the months ahead, it's just rife with contradictions and with difficulties. And I might also add, which was new to me, a little sense of danger on the part of the Americans that were over there, in the sense that in the chaos within the military, they really don't know who to trust. You know, I'll end it by saying that, you know, Dave Petraeus said that that building the Iraqi military was like trying to design an airplane while it's flying. One guy put it to me, he says, you know, today it's like trying to design an airplane while it's flying that's running out of fuel, has no food on board, the pilot has parachuted out of the airplane, and there's no leg room, and it's going to crash anyway. With that optimistic tone, I'll pass it to the next person. Yeah.
So with that very rosy picture, yes, that Bob just painted, Daniel Wagner, perhaps you could put it in a maybe a different perspective.
Well, I wish I could say that I was going to put this all in an optimistic frame, but that wasn't what I intended to do even before I heard the general's comments. Thank you for that. Actually, it's enlightening to hear someone with your background have an orientation and that of your colleagues to what's going on, which seems so rather honest, which we don't necessarily often hear in the media. Let me read you something that was sent to me that I think neatly encapsulates the problem that we have in Iraq now. It goes like this. We support the Iraqi government in the fight against ISIS. We don't like ISIS, but ISIS is supported by Saudi Arabia, whom we do like. We don't like Assad in Syria. We support the fight against him, but ISIS is also fighting against him. We don't like Iran, but Iran supports the Iraqi government in its fight against ISIS. So some of our friends, hang on a second, I got cut off. Where did it go? Sorry. So some of our friends support our enemies, some enemies are now our friends, and some of our enemies are fighting against our other enemies, whom we want to lose. But we don't want our enemies who are fighting our enemies to win. If the people we want to defeat are defeated, they could be replaced by people we like even less. And so that's the dilemma that we have today, which is, in essence, we did all that we did since 2003 to, in essence, get rid of a Sunni tyrant and replace him with a Shia tyrant, which I don't think was our intention, but that's ultimately what happened. In 2004, I published an article called A Western Fix for Iraq, Forget It. And I was basically saying that based on the power of tribalism and history and the fact that Iraq was created with false borders to begin with, legacy issues from the French and the British, et cetera, the Ottoman Empire, that there wasn't much chance that our effort was going to succeed. And I wish I could sit before you and say that I was terribly wrong. I would have loved to have been wrong. But 10 years ago, I predicted, basically, that what would happen is that the place would fall apart and would likely end up in three separate states. There's an argument now that's going on that basically says we need to do everything that we can to keep it together. And the reason that we need to do that is the sanctity of borders and the future of the region, et cetera. But what I think we're losing sight of is the fact that the Sunnis and the Shia have been slugging it out for centuries. And centuries from now, they're still going to be slugging it out. I find myself having a difficult time justifying expending more effort trying to contain the problem. I do find myself saying, why don't we let the forces of history do what they've done so far and see what happens? Caught in the middle are a bunch of people who are innocent victims and are, as the Syrian playwright Sadallah Wanous has said, condemned to hope, basically cornered between two or three terrible options, you know, stagnant repression, a stagnant state, and nowhere to go. So all they have is hope. At the end of the day, my view is that the only way that they will ever see a better day is if the forces of history do what they're going to do and whatever happens, happens, because we tried to control that, letting the genie out of the bottle, et cetera, and it wasn't going to work. What needs to happen, of course, is that there needs to be free markets, you know, letting up of state control, all of those things that we want to see, the democratization process. But you don't go from 0 to 60 when you do that. It takes decades. It's not going to take 5 years or even 10. It will take decades to accomplish that. Where do we go from here vis-a-vis ISIS? I share some of the general's colleagues' view that basically those gains that have been made, it seems to me, are unlikely to be lost. Right now, ISIS controls a state about the size of Jordan, about the population of Jordan, and this sort of no man's land, if you will, between Aleppo and western Iraq. Doesn't seem to me that it's likely that that's going to change anytime soon. We're not going to be changing it. I don't see any forces in the region that have the wherewithal to change it. So my guess is that ISIS is only going to be strengthened from here on out by some of the gains that they've made, the money that they've made, the people who are joining their battle, and we need to be prepared to deal with that. Let me just shift gears a little bit and talk about what organizations might be able to do to prepare themselves to go into a place like that. Well, just a couple of quick comments. One is that it certainly reemphasizes the importance of doing due diligence, but due diligence is also done, often done with the idea that you're going to have a certain paradigm in place that doesn't change. It's not meant necessarily to be done when the paradigm is shifting. So that can really have an impact on the effectiveness of the effort. And secondarily, knowing your customer, certainly KYC in all capital letters on that one, well, shifting sands as well. There's only so much anyone can do to try and manage the risk management process in a place like that. What it was 10 years ago is not what it is today and not what it's going to be in 10 years from now. Thank you.
On that note, with Dan ending and saying know your customer and that it's a shifting sand, I think what we've seen, we, as Dante probably alluded to earlier, in the last couple of weeks, we have a lot of clients that we've been working with who have assets and employees on the ground, who have financial investments on the ground, and are, from a tactical standpoint, extremely panicked. You know, everybody knows when you enter into countries like Iraq or many parts of the world, challenging environments, that there is always that risk. You know, that something may break out security-wise, or even epidemics and things like this. But that doesn't really change the response that you need to be providing for your employees and protecting your assets. From a tactical standpoint, what we've been obviously advising clients in the last couple of weeks is really, and starting in January actually, really Iraq started to come up quite a bit in conversations that could things go worse? You know, when it started in January with Al Anbar province, the conversation at that time was, could security really change? But then the hope was, maybe not, because of all that you've heard recently here. But then the situation today is that it has changed. Companies with assets, employees, and financial investments have very limited options if you're already on the ground right now. Employees, definitely you can take measures, and many companies have done that already, to bring them out to Erbil or Dubai or back into their home countries. However, that's creating another challenge. Erbil is strained with resources, and I'm sure here at the audience, you may have a lot of employees or assets, or information about Erbil and how it's becoming drained on resources, to the fact that, including the fact that there are no hotels as well available, decent hotels with decent fire protection measures, things like this. I mean, there was an incident several years back in Erbil where a lot of the expats, the hotel burned down, and a lot of the expats were stuck. And there were over 300 U.S. Nationals that unfortunately were deceased in that hotel fire. So this is causing concerns to the companies and organizations operating there as to what next. Is it a long-term plan to evacuate? Is it a short-term plan to evacuate? What do you do about assets that cannot be mobilized at all? And this is not just applicable to Iraq, really, for any such country. Pre-deployment, just like the due diligence, we always say risk management and insurance diligence also needs to be done when you are looking at deploying in such countries. You need to have contingency measures in place. You need to know who are the assistance companies, security companies that can assist getting employees out. What do you do about the assets that are already there? Can you mobilize heavy equipments, armored vehicles, which also is another big area of concern for a lot of the US government contractors that are using these armored and tactical vehicles for delivery of US government work? How do you secure those vehicles? How do you make sure they don't fall into the wrong hands? When you have to evacuate a city, you're pretty much leaving everything behind as it is, hoping that once things stabilize, the losses are minimized. For that, you need to have insurances in place. And it's not about insuring the right or buying everything possible for that country. It's about buying the right kind of insurances, making sure whatever is there in place does respond. From an insurance, just to end on a note on the insurance market, how is it reacting to Iraq? Clearly, things are tightening up for the insurance market. There are no capacities or virtually very limited capacities available in the insurance market if you were to go out now to buy insurance for Iraq. But that's not to say that insurance is not available. It's still available. It's available based on where the assets are, where the employees are. One of the other things that's happening is that clients, when something like this happens, there is a lot of panic buying that happens, which drives up the prices. So a lot of companies are now coming in and saying, we need to buy insurance for Iraq, or within Iraq, Baghdad right now. And that's one place where you would obviously see insurance companies quoting much higher than they would have previously quoted. So our advice has always been, instead of getting into the culture of panic buying, do plan insurance before. Insurance can be extremely expensive for places like this. U.S. government has helped make insurance a priority when working in such locations. So if you are a company that has planned well, you would actually have all those insurances in place. Now, then begs the question, do you have procedures in place to call on those insurances? I mean, it's insurance can only respond if you're well organized as well. If the insurance companies do not know where your own employees are or your assets are, how would they respond? And that's been another challenge for us in the last couple of weeks, is where we see incidents coming in or claims coming in, the clients may not have a visibility on what is happening on the ground with their assets and their locations. I think the quotes that you will be seeing these days for Iraq, and in fact many places in the Middle East and Africa, are with very limited validity, which means it's on as-on-date basis, or 3 days validity, which means you really don't have much time to even decide. You know, it's kind of like you get a sticker shock first, and then you have to decide within 24 hours, or really 3 days. So things like this, and it's also, I mean, in the news and in our insurance circle or risk management side, you hear a lot of news about political risk. But there is a whole lot of other risk that you are going to be probably seeing more claims on, such as, you know, really fire risk or things like this, and, you know, employee-related accidents, making sure they're housed in the right kind of environment, things like this. So do worry about or do look at policies that you have in place for not just political risk, but other risk as well. It's really, I mean, this is, I think, from a tactical standpoint, what do companies do really at this stage, you know, where Iraq is already where it is? Thank you.
Great. So I could imagine with the capacity crowd that we have here, and I think these illuminating comments, some of them, of course, cast a very, very dark cloud over Iraq and the prospects for the country. I think what we could do now is turn it to the audience for a series of questions. I'll call on the person asking the question, and we may have microphones on hand. Great. So this gentleman right here in the front row.
Oda Aberdeen, a consultant on Gulf Affairs.
Can you speak up?
Oda Aberdeen. I listened to all of you, and just need to go back a little bit to history. Because when we talk about Iraq today, we talk about Iraq in the last 30 years. First, the notion that the Sunnis and the Shiites have been fighting from the start. It's partly true, partly wrong. The Turks controlled Iraq for 400 years. The Turks were Sunni Muslims. They were Iraqis, whether they were Shiite and Sunnis in the Turkish army, were forming nationalist cells, and they fought against the Turkish presence. In the 20s, when the British came, the uprising in the 20s, which is similar to what's happening today, you had Shiites and Sunni fighting the British presence. Thirdly, the Ba'ath Party was formed by Shiites mainly, and a lot of Sunnis joined. So let's not overplay this Sunni-Shia. Lastly, I think both Iraqi Sunnis and Iraqi Shiites are Iraqi nationalists first, and eventually Iraq will come back. And now, as far as ISIS, again, we have to go into history, and unfortunately, we don't read history. Throughout Arab history, after the Prophet died, you had many groups like ISIS, whom I call people who believe in absurdities, and when people believe in absurdities, they committed atrocities. And these groups eventually died. You had hundreds of these groups rise and fall because these people have nothing to offer Iraqis. Iraqis want education. Iraqis want medicine. Iraqis want jobs. So let's not over-magnify these groups. Eventually, the Iraqis will take care of these people. What needs to be done is to create an Iraq that is fair for everyone. And finally, the invasion of Iraq disempowered one group and empowered one other group. In the first 2-3 years of the invasion, one group that was disempowered suffered, they were marginalized, until the great General Petraeus came in and tried to reintegrate Iraq. Thank you.
So,
let me answer you. First of all, I'm a little bit upset that you presume that we don't read history. And I have a PhD in history, so I read history. Secondly, you're right. We have the rise of these different radical groups like the Mahdi you're referring to and others. And that's true, but, you know, sometimes these radical groups are influential for 300 years. So I hear what you're saying, and perhaps ISIL is a flash in the political pan, or perhaps it's the beginning of a movement that could last generations. All I can say to you is everything you said is very interesting, but I'll tell you right now, at this stage, even smart historians like you and me, we don't know. And it's a huge question mark. So I'd love to support you and make proclamations that ISIL will disappear like a flash in the pan. Perhaps it will, but I have no assurances one way or the other.
Sorry, Missy.
No, I'll just add, I mean, it's certainly true that ISIL does not enjoy the support of the majority of Iraqis, but, you know, and I think there's actually been polling done recently, not in Iraq, but in Syria, about ISIL, and it's shown that it has very little support among the Syrian people. And I think you could assume the same thing in Iraq, but there's no arguing that it has been, so far at least, extremely successful in exploiting the existing tensions or frustrations that existed in Iraq in places like Anbar and Nineveh and Salahuddin. And, you know, maybe that won't last very long, and certainly I would expect that there would be deepening divisions and perhaps violence between the ISIL component of the insurgency and then the, you know, the old guard that I mentioned earlier. But, you know, I don't think that those two things can't be true at the same time, that, you know, ISIL doesn't appeal to all Iraqis. It doesn't mean that they can't be successful in the short term, at least to a limited extent.
I would just add to that very briefly. The jury will be out for some time, I think, on how successful or unsuccessful they will be. But if they are to be successful, they have to win over the hearts and minds of the people. And they probably don't have to go too far to do that from a basic needs perspective, because the government's failed to do that. And it's basically a failed state for all intents and purposes. And the area in which ISIS operates is that of a failed state. So if they're able to do something like the Muslim Brotherhood was in Egypt and meet basic needs, they may find that they're political orientation, their success may change.
Okay. Gentleman in the green tie.
Hi, Harry Blaney, Center for International Policy. When listening to the whole panel, I get the first reaction is that the only thing we can do is just hold up our hands and stand by. It seems to me that may be not, in the end, the only options that are available overall. There's a lot of diplomatic work. There is some work that military can be done. But it is probably one of trying to bring, putting together the broken pieces as best one can, including perhaps the plan for a dismembered or partly dismembered Iraq. But it seems to me that the things that were not addressed, and I wish the panel would go back on, one is the argument that has been made by the president and others that a ISIS area that spans from Syria to Iraq is a danger to us because it can be a staging ground for attacks on Europe and on the United States, and I would like you to respond to that. And the second element that's at work is the humanitarian aspects. As Americans, we are not happy with mass bloodshed and the killing of innocents right and left in a large way. And that's one of the options that are out there. And one has to ask the question, I would put it to the panel, what do we do about that, if anything? And finally, the solution of trying to work out some kind of an agreement among the existing powers, the Kurds particularly are important, and the second of obviously what's a building now and whether anything can be done to replace Maliki and put some semblance of unity of the at least the, some Sunni and some Shia together there to at least hold, if you would, some unity and put in resources that can provide for the people or be seen to be provide the people in this process. So that's my questions, and I'd like Lenin to ask what can be done.
I'll answer two. One is a terrorist deal. A global response by ISIL, but not now, not soon. There's no evidence that ISIL, unlike Al-Qaeda, has a sort of foreign wing. It may grow to that. God knows, with 8 million people under their wing, it might happen. But they're a long way, maybe years away from even beginning to consolidate this Sunnistan area that people are referring to. And I just can't see it happening anytime soon. The United States, to your point, there are things that we can do. The president derisively said that we don't do whack-a-mole. Well, actually, yes, we do whack-a-mole, and we do it very well, thank you. And whack-a-mole is actually a pretty good strategy for dealing with insurgencies like this, at least keeping them down and focused on survival rather than exporting terrorism. The second point I'll address is humanitarianism. Yeah, I hear you, and this is very much a big deal in the liberal left, and we really did well in Cambodia, Rwanda, fill in the blanks. The odds that the American military will be put on the ground in anywhere in the Middle East to prevent a humanitarian atrocity, I would suggest to you, is zero.
I can address the political, the need for a political agreement. I mean, this is absolutely what the Obama administration has been trying to broker in one form or another since 2011. The U.S. strategy since the withdrawal in 2011 has been twofold. One has been the provision of sophisticated weaponry like Apache helicopters and Hellfire missiles. A lot of that, unfortunately, has been held up in the sort of cumbersome U.S. procurement process and has not arrived in Iraq yet. And the second one, to your point, is there's been constant over years sort of cajoling and trying to bring together Iraqi political leaders in the same room to get them to talk to each other. And that's been done on a sort of mid to sort of upper middle level of the U.S. government, occasionally with intervention by Joe Biden. And, you know, I think that we just haven't been able to exercise effective leverage to make that happen so far. And obviously that's been kicked up a level since late last year when things started getting bad in Anbar. I think that there are some reasons to think that we have additional leverage now because Iraq so badly needs our military assistance, but I certainly don't think it's a foregone conclusion that the unity government that we're looking for will come together.
Agreed.
Thanks. I'm Chip House from the Alliance for Peacebuilding, and this is more for you, General, but it may be for all of you. I spent the weekend reading Gideon Rose's new book on ending war and then heard him speak at USIP with a whole bunch of people in dress uniform from your place, your old place. And one of the questions that Rose asks is when you try to end a war, when you go into a war, you should have the end state in mind. And I hear you talk and I hear my friends from, you know, the War College talk, and I don't have an answer to this, but it sounds like his notion of reverse engineering. You start with what you want to end up with and then try to get there. But somehow, in the case of Iraq, we invested, depending on how you count, a gazillion dollars and a gazillion lives of your colleagues in that place. And this is what comes out of it. How can we prepare better for these kind of events in the future? Because you're right. I mean, my folks didn't do a good job in Rwanda or any of the other places you mentioned. How do we help you guys do your job better the next time?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, you do get 3 credited hours for the Army War College. You alone. I know. Let me make a couple of points very briefly. Number one is the United States does a terrible job in predicting the place, the time, the circumstances and the nature of the enemy in future conflicts. I mean, if Harry Truman didn't know where Korea was on the 25th of June, 1950, Lyndon Johnson knew that the price for his silliness would have been 58,000 dead of my colleagues, he never would have done it. And George Bush had no intention of fighting two wars for a decade. So our ability, the $85 billion a year we spend on conflict prediction, we're about 0 for 12. We do that terribly. The second thing is we have a wonderful understanding, whether it's Rose or Clausewitz or Cohen or you name the strategist, of understanding the whole principle of ends, ways, and means. What we don't understand is ends. Generally speaking, our wars begin through mutual miscalculation and hubris and spin out of control, and all of a sudden, as a nation, we don't want to be embarrassed, and so we drag it on, in some cases, for decades. Look, when the president's wife rolls over and said, George, we've got to do something about those people, then all of the war colleges and all of the strategy and all the books don't count for a damn thing. It's all instinctual, it's all capricious, it's all virtually all unplanned. Look, every war America is ever going to fight is going to be short, sharp, glorious, and focused on technology. And oh, by the way, if you look at what they're doing in the Pentagon today, that's exactly what they're saying. Have you heard about this new gig for fighting China called Air Sea Battle? We don't have that many bullets. So, yeah, I think our intelligence system and our system for developing strategy is amateurish. It is poorly formed, and a great many well-educated people, some of whom are in this room, when America starts to slide down the slippery slope to warfare, for whatever reason, we just seem to fall apart. It's just how we are.
So, if I may, I think, General, thanks for sharing your honest opinion there. I think part of the additional comment to make to that question is we're in an era where we're conflating the work of the Pentagon with nation building. And the very
that's
group that's meant to destroy nations isn't meant to rebuild them, and that's
right.
Part of, I think, the vacuum that we need to fill. So I wanted to try and ask a question of my own, if I may, about what other things are being done to encourage stability. So we have, for example, in the room, a number of colleagues representing OPIC, Overseas Private Investment Corporation, U.S. government entity designed to offer political risk insurance, designed to spur foreign direct investment, designed to grow small and medium-sized enterprises in countries. And so, I don't know, maybe Daniel, maybe Smita, you could comment a little bit on what are the non-military solutions, because ultimately that's the vacuum that ISIS is filling in Iraq and the proto-state that they're filling, to Daniel's point about the failed state. What non-military solutions are in place to stabilize this?
Let me just start the conversation by saying if you're an insurance person or you're an investment person, to this gentleman's point earlier, stay out of the fault lines. Stay out of the creases. Stay away from the global fault lines that many great historians have been writing about for years. Pay attention to culture and geography and draw lines on the global map that are no-go places for you. And that's the intersection. It's the great Pan-Arabian swath across the middle and the vertical crease that separates Europe from Asia. There is nothing, I believe, over the long term that justifies investment in these regions, which are perennial sources of conflict.
Spoken like a true political risk insurance underwriter. You sure you haven't done that as a previous?
No, position? I haven't.
Well, look, I mean, speaking on that topic, I don't think that there are very many insurers in that class of business who would be in business for very long if two things didn't happen. One is if they didn't know how to say no thank you when it was appropriate, but secondarily, if they didn't know how to say yes when it was an appropriate opportunity. And the old adage goes there can be good deals in bad countries and bad deals in good countries, and your ability to detect them is what separates good from bad underwriters. I just wanted to say a couple of words related to both of the previous questions. One is, it seems to me that if we are going to gain anything from what we've just been through and what Iraq and the region has just been through over the last 10 plus years, we need to learn some lessons, and we need to absorb them in our psyche, and we need to translate them into policymaking. Because one of the things that I still see happening on the Sunday morning programs is people who were responsible for presiding over and enforcing the actions of the Bush administration in Iraq are still hammering the same hammer on the same nail, talking the same points 10 years later. It just mystifies me how they can do that with a straight face. Secondarily, I think coalition building is extremely important, but we're not in a particularly good position to be doing that at the moment because so many of our allies are either alienated or they are in transition. And so it's probably a little bit premature to even be thinking about how we can remake our alliances in the region. That's going to be a work in progress for some time as well.
And if I may add to Dante's question, just to address some point. What we, you know, and this is out of personal experience with working with companies in Iraq, you know, specifically in Iraq, over the last years, over the last couple of years, there were a lot of U.S. Companies and organizations and subcontractors working in the same area, same cities in Iraq, side by side. Some of them had a lot more claims, incidents, and you know, claims, really, deaths, including deaths, unfortunately, then the same company or their peers working in the same location in the same way. What was the difference? And if you talk to companies such as yourselves, one of the things was working with the community, hiring local nationals out of the community, embedding yourself in the community, working alongside local, you know, whether it's non-governmental organizations or it is local companies that are looking also to rebuild Iraq, also to rebuild their communities. And I think those are the places you've actually seen a lot less claims. And those are the companies where, you know, insurers would also be looking to continually support even now, you know, when something like this happens. The second point and the last point I would like to make is even in, you know, even when you're looking at investments flowing, you know, I mean, financial investments flowing out of from U.S. government, U.S. organizations into local companies and things like this, or a lot of assets transiting through the entire Middle East and oil transiting through the entire Middle East and things. Again, the same approach has been taken by those companies as well, is to have the buy-in of the local local community, you know, to work with the local community. And that's what is going to guarantee to them the protection and the safe passage of employees and assets. So I think for the non, you know, sort of military side things, I think we have to be embedding with the local communities.
That's a great point. So I think we have time for two more questions. I know there's a lot of hands, so we'll take this gentleman right here.
Good afternoon. I'm Ross Clark from the Center for Complex Operations at the National Defense University. General Soleimani of Iran's elite Quds Force has had large influence on the past Iraqi political system. So my question for you is, what will the future of this influence be, and how will this impact future security political systems, and also in regards with the upcoming election? Thank you.
I think that's overplayed. And I think we do it for internal political reasons rather than for geostrategic understanding of the region. Remember, Iraq fought Iran for 8.5 years, had 250,000 people killed on the Iraqi side, and God only knows, some say close to 1 million Iranians killed in that war. In a place of the world where clan and ethnicity trumps nationalism, at the end of the day, the Iranians are Persians and the Iraqis are Arabs. I hear what you're saying. They're more, the Iraqis will take help from anybody right now because they're so desperate, to include the Quds Force if they have it, if they offer it. But the idea that somehow Maliki and his Shiite followers are going to become a vassal state to Persia, I think, as has been played up in the media and in my own network, I think is something that frankly is overstated.
I'd agree with that. I mean, there's no doubt that there's, you know, even some on the ground Iranian military advising
right.
happening, which is, frankly, I don't think a huge problem. You know, there, as Bob just said, they need a lot of help in many different ways. And, you know, there's a close cultural, military, and political relationship with Iran. I would make one additional point, which is that if the White House decides not to provide direct, substantial military assistance to Iraq in the current situation, that there's a good chance that the next government, you know, which will be led by somebody probably either from Maliki's State of Law Party or from ISKI, will embrace Iran in a new way just out of necessity. But of course, there are limitations to that, and the Iraqis are nationalists first.
Yeah, but one other point. The real 800-pound gorilla in your question is nuclear weapons. All of the stuff we're talking about now falls into the meaningless if Iran gets a nuke. And God forbid our concern about the intrusion of Iran into Iraq would cause us in any way to give up our steadfast approach to denuclearizing Iran, then shame on us. Because the long-term threat to the United States isn't ISIS building shoe bombers. It's Iran getting a nuclear weapon. And I think that would change the complexion of the Middle East far more decisively than what's going on now. It's a great question, by the way. You get 3 credit hours, even though you're with NDU.
Thanks for the panel. I'm Patrick Garvey with Triple Canopy. We're operating in strong presence in Iraq, continued. And if you're looking to outsource your risk, give us a call. We'll help you out there. I've written several questions over time, but I think the one I boil down to is, can you, General, do you think we can support the Iraqi army without propping up Maliki at this point?
No.
Or can we, you know, is it worth playing the delay game until he's gone?
Boy, what a great question. Let me give you a very short answer because I know we're running out of time. Here's my make on it. There are many things that we can do to from a military perspective, to maintain stability and reverse the encroachment of ISIL in the region. It doesn't necessarily have to be tied to Maliki. There are 3 things we can do. One, we can do the advise and assist function, but we're all over the map on this, as my friends have told me. If you're going to do that, you have to not pick your politicians carefully, but pick your military units carefully. Focus on the elite, the commandos, the SWAT, Iraqi police, and those units that are reliable, not to Maliki, but to the nation, that identify themselves as Iraqis rather than Shia militia. Secondly, is that we have to restore a ISR presence over Iraq, not because we want to prop up Maliki, but that's how we keep our eyes on a region which, as I said earlier, has virtually gone black. Number 3 is we have to maintain the whack-a-mole business that the president so decries in the region, because that's our ace in the hole. That's what we didn't have over Afghanistan after 9/11. So whoever is in office in Iraq, we need, within the CENTCOM AOR, we need to have to reestablish and make robust our special operations and strategic surveillance capabilities so that, God forbid, if ISIL begins to export terrorism, or even worse, if Iran gets, or if they get their hands on fissile material and do something worse, we cannot start from scratch the ability to take these people out, not to save Maliki, but to keep this brand of terrorism away from our shores.
Just to push back very slightly on one point you made, which is that it's absolutely true that the elite and the counterterrorism forces are by far the most effective within the Iraqi military sphere at this point, but they're the very forces who report directly to the Prime Minister's office, and that could be a problem again in the next government, depending on who that leader is.
Exactly.
And that was supposed to be fixed as a result of the Kurdish, Sunni, and Shiite agreement that allowed the 2010 government to be formed, but it never happened.
See, Missy's right. The problem we have now, at least as it reported to me, is we don't know who our friends are. Or I should say, we don't know who our reliable friends are. And we have to sort that out first. And once we've done that, then military aid can flow. But you can't have a carte blanche approach to supporting Maliki, because it'll simply backfire on us. And may wind up, as your wonderful quote just said, we may wind up becoming friends of our enemies again. So this must be done in a measured, careful approach that doesn't panic and overreact. Otherwise, all this could wind up, we could wind up making all this worse.
So with that hopeful message from the general, I think the only voice missing on this panel was that of a diplomat. I think everybody else absolutely shared their views, and we appreciate the panelists for taking their time and appreciate the audience for taking the time to join us this afternoon. Personally, I was coming with the view that I would get some answers, and I hope that you leave with the same sense. It is clearly a fast-moving, fairly desperate situation. I don't know if I personally subscribe to all the grim narrative, but as Daniel would say, the arc of history is a long one, and with it, I think even countries like Iraq can settle. So thanks again, and thanks to the American Security Project for hosting us and for all of you to join us this afternoon. Thanks.